A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know that moment when you've just landed at Heathrow or JFK? You're taxiing off the runway, and you glance out the window toward the parallel runway? And there it is, this string of lights stretching back into the darkness. One aircraft touching down, another maybe 2 miles out, a third just visible, and beyond that, just lights as far as you can see. Thousands of people from everywhere on the planet, all funneling toward the same strip of pavement at hundreds of miles per hour. Daniel sent us this one, and he's asking the question that image always provokes. How do air traffic controllers actually manage that sequence? What's the invisible choreography behind that visual funnel? And at the busiest times, how many aircraft can be queued toward a major airport at once?
That funnel of lights is mesmerizing, but what's actually happening inside it? Let's break down the system that makes it possible. And the first thing to understand is that what you're seeing from the tarmac window is maybe the last 15 to 20 minutes of a process that started 200 nautical miles and 45 minutes earlier. The controllers aren't just lining planes up at the last second, they're building a sequence from way out, like a conductor who's been cueing musicians long before the audience hears the first note.
The visual funnel is basically the final movement of a symphony that's been running for an hour.
And the term for the overall system is arrival sequencing, or sometimes arrival metering. The key constraint driving everything is that a runway has a fixed maximum throughput. Heathrow's two runways, for example, can handle about 48 arrivals per hour in good visibility. That's one aircraft every 75 seconds. In low visibility conditions, that drops to about 36 per hour. The entire system, the holding stacks, the speed control, the vectoring, is built around feeding that rate with surgical precision. Too slow, and you waste capacity that can never be recovered. Too fast, and you create a safety hazard or force a go-around that disrupts the entire sequence.
48 per hour. So if you're a controller and you deliver 49, you've actually created a problem, not solved one.
Right. And that's the counterintuitive part that most people don't get. It's not a manufacturing line where more throughput is always better. The runway is a fixed resource. Over-delivering means aircraft stacking up with nowhere to go. So the controller's job is to hit exactly the number the runway can absorb, not a single aircraft more.
Like bartenders at a stadium during halftime. Pour faster than customers can carry drinks away, and you just create a puddle.
A puddle of jet fuel and aluminum. But let me get into the actual mechanics. So how do controllers sequence these aircraft? It starts with separation standards that are surprisingly precise. In en-route airspace, the standard is 3 nautical miles lateral or 1,000 feet vertical between aircraft. But on final approach, the spacing becomes time-based. The standard minimum is typically 2.5 to 4 minutes between arrivals, and the exact number depends on something called wake turbulence category.
Wake turbulence? This is the invisible threat, right? The disturbed air that a big aircraft leaves behind it.
It's not just a gentle bump. A heavy aircraft, an A380, a 747, a 777, generates wingtip vortices that can persist for 2 to 3 minutes. These are essentially horizontal tornadoes spinning off the wingtips. If a smaller aircraft flies into one, it can be rolled completely inverted. There have been accidents. So controllers categorize every aircraft heavy, which is anything over 136 metric tons takeoff weight. Then there's a special B757 category because the 757 generates wake more like a heavy despite being lighter than medium, which is most narrow-body aircraft, and light, which is your Cessnas and small turboprops.
The BC57 gets its own category, the diva of wake turbulence.
It really is. The 757 has these unusually aggressive vortices for its weight class, and it earned that category after some close calls in the 90s. But the key numbers, a medium following a heavy, needs 5 nautical miles of separation, which works out to about 2 minutes at approach speeds. A heavy following another heavy only needs 4 miles. Two mediums back-to-back can go down to 3 miles. And the extreme case, A light aircraft following a heavy needs 6 miles. The A380 specifically requires 4 minutes of separation behind it for a medium, compared to 2 minutes for a 737 following another 737.
That A380 that just landed. The controller is now running a 4-minute timer before the next 737 can touch down. And if they misjudge that by 30 seconds, they've either wasted capacity or created a hazard.
That's where the really interesting innovation comes in. Since 2015, Eurocontrol and NATS, that's the UK's air traffic control provider, have deployed something called time-based separation, or TBS, at Heathrow. Instead of using fixed distances, controllers use time-based spacing that accounts for headwind. Here's why that matters. A strong headwind slows an aircraft's ground speed, which means the distance it covers in 2 minutes is shorter. But the wake vortices also dissipate faster in a strong headwind because the wind breaks them up. So, TBS says, if the headwind is strong, we can reduce the distance between aircraft while maintaining the same time gap because the vortices are being swept away more quickly. In practice, this recovered about 4 landings per hour at Heathrow in windy conditions that would otherwise have forced wider spacing.
That's elegant. The physics of the hazard and the physics of the weather are linked, so you can exploit that. 4 extra landings per hour in a storm. That's the difference between delays cascading through the whole day or not.
Heathrow desperately needs every one of those slots. It's running at over 98% capacity on its 2 runways. There's no slack. But before we get to the final approach, I want to talk about what's happening further out, because that's where the real invisible architecture lives. The tool that makes all this possible is called an Arrival Manager, or AMA. It's a decision support system that starts calculating the optimal sequence when aircraft are still 200 nautical miles from the airport. It assigns each aircraft a slot, essentially a calculated time to cross a specific waypoint called the metering fix. That metering fix is like the entry gate to the final approach funnel.
The computer is doing the math, but the controller is still making the calls?
The controller always has final authority. The AMA is making recommendations. It's saying, if you slow this 777 to 250 knots now, and have this A320 hold at Bovingdon for 8 minutes, the whole sequence will merge perfectly at the metering fix, and you'll hit 48 per hour. The controller can accept that, modify it, or override it. But the system is doing the kind of multivariable optimization that would be impossible for a human to calculate in real time. It's tracking dozens of aircraft, each with different speeds, different distances, different weight categories, and it's solving a giant puzzle every time the situation changes.
The situation changes constantly. Weather shifts. An aircraft requests a different runway. Someone declares an emergency.
Which brings us to holding stacks. When demand temporarily exceeds capacity, maybe weather just reduced the arrival rate from 48 to 36, the excess aircraft don't just wander around. They're assigned to holding patterns at specific fixes. For Heathrow, the main one is Bovingdon, northwest of London. For JFK, it's Lendi and several others. Each stack has multiple vertical levels separated by 1,000 feet. An aircraft enters at the top and controllers step it down as the one below is released into the approach flow. It's like a multi-story parking garage in the sky.
The aircraft is literally flying in circles, burning fuel, waiting for its number to be called.
That's the part that sounds like a failure to passengers. You hear, we've been given a holding pattern, and you groan. But it's not a failure. It's a deliberate buffer. The system is trading fuel for safety and order. Without holding stacks, you'd have aircraft arriving at the metering fix in random order, creating chaos on final approach. The stacks are shock absorbers.
The queues, basically. The same way a restaurant puts your name on a list and you wait at the bar. Except the bar is at 14,000 feet, and you're burning $1,000 of kerosene per orbit.
That cost is why the system has another layer, flow control. When it's clear that demand is going to exceed capacity for an extended period, the system doesn't just let aircraft take off and then hold them, it delays them on the ground. In the US, this is called a Ground Delay Program, or GDP. The FII's Air Traffic Control System Command Center calculates that if they let everyone depart on time, they'll have 40 aircraft in holding over JFK within 2 hours. So instead, they assign departure slots. Your flight might be held at the gate in Chicago for 30 minutes rather than circling over New York for 20. The GDP delayed over 150,000 flights in 2025 with an average ground hold of 22 minutes.
That number is staggering. 150,000 flights held on the ground. And I'd bet most passengers had no idea they were part of a deliberate delay program. They just thought their flight was late.
The airline rarely explains it well. But here's the thing. A ground hold is actually the efficient option. Fuel burn in a holding pattern is roughly double what you'd burn taxiing or sitting at the gate. And you're not burning arrival capacity. A ground delay absorbs the same excess demand at a fraction of the cost and with zero safety impact.
The system has layers. Ground delays first, then holding stacks if the imbalance is shorter term, then the AMAN sequence, then the final approach with weight turbulence spacing. It's a cascade of buffers.
Each buffer has a cost. Ground delays cost passenger time and airline schedule integrity. Holding stacks cost fuel. Tight final approach spacing costs controller cognitive load. The art is choosing which cost to pay at any given moment.
Let me ask about the cognitive load part. You mentioned earlier that controllers are handling dozens of aircraft simultaneously. At a busy approach facility like London Terminal Control Center or New York TRACON, what's the actual per controller workload?
London Terminal Control Center handles over 2,000 flights per day across 6 sectors. Each sector controller is managing up to 12 aircraft simultaneously at peak times. That's 12 moving objects in three-dimensional space, each at different speeds, different altitudes, different headings, with different destinations and different weight categories. And each one requires a decision roughly every 30 to 60 seconds. Speed change, altitude change, heading change, handoff to the next sector.
12 doesn't sound like a lot until you realize each one is traveling at 400 knots and a mistake kills hundreds of people.
The cognitive load is managed through a practice called sector splitting. When traffic exceeds a threshold, a sector is divided into two, each with its own controller and its own radio frequency. It's like a restaurant adding the second host during the dinner rush. The trade-off is coordination overhead. Every split sector requires handoffs between the two controllers, and handoffs are where errors happen. So you split only when the traffic load makes it unavoidable.
It's the same scaling problem that every complex system faces. More parallelism means more coordination, and coordination has its own cost.
That's why tools like point merge are so interesting. Let me explain what Heathrow did. Traditional approach control involves a lot of radar vectoring. The controller gives aircraft headings to fly, essentially drawing a path through the sky with radio calls. It's high workload and it makes the sequence hard to predict. Point merge replaces that with a structured geometry. Aircraft fly along an arc at a fixed distance from the runway. It's like a curved shelf in the sky. When the controller is ready to sequence an aircraft, they give a single instruction, turn direct to the runway. The aircraft leaves the arc and flies straight in. Because the arc is at a known distance, the time from turn to threshold is predictable. This reduced controller workload and increased throughput by about 10% at Heathrow.
Instead of the controller drawing a custom path for every aircraft, they're just releasing them from a pre-built queue. It's like moving from a whiteboard to a Kanban board.
JFK has its own interesting variant. They use something called Tower En Route Control, or TE. There's a specialized controller in the tower who manages the final 10-mile approach sequence and hands off to the local controller only at the runway threshold. Most airports have the TRACON controller handle the final approach all the way to landing. JFK inserts an extra layer specifically to optimize that last 10 miles, because the airspace around New York is so congested that the final approach corridor intersects with departures from LaGuardia and Newark.
Three major airports within, what, 30 miles of each other. The airspace must look like spaghetti.
It's the most complex airspace in the world. And that's why JFK developed TERC. The approach sequence is so delicate that it needs a dedicated controller whose only job is the final 10 miles. They're not thinking about the holding stack or the metering fix. They're thinking about wake turbulence spacing, runway occupancy time, and whether that A380 is going to clear the runway before the 737 behind it reaches the decision height.
Which brings up something I've always wondered. What happens when a go-around occurs? One aircraft aborts the landing at the last second. How does that ripple through the whole sequence?
This is where the fragility of the system really shows. A go-around at a major airport can disrupt the sequence for 5 to 10 minutes. The aircraft that went around needs to be resequenced. It climbs back out, rejoins the pattern, and gets a new slot. Meanwhile, the aircraft behind it are already on final approach, spaced for the assumption that the runway would be clear. The controller has to make split-second decisions. Do I send the next aircraft around too? Can I slow the third aircraft enough to create a gap? At Heathrow, a go-around happens roughly once every 3 days. Most are routine. An aircraft was slow to clear the runway or the spacing got tight, but each one is a cascade of micro-decisions.
Once every 3 days at Heathrow. So roughly 1 per 1,000 landings. That's remarkably low.
It is, and it's a testament to how precise the system normally runs. But the low frequency also means controllers don't get to practice go-around management very often. It's a high-stakes, low-frequency event, exactly the kind of thing that human factors researchers worry about.
Let's shift to the edge cases. You mentioned the A380 requires 4 minutes behind it for a medium. What's the most extreme pairing? An A380 followed by a Cessna.
That would be 6 nautical miles and about 3 to 4 minutes. But in practice, that pairing almost never happens at a major airport because light aircraft are typically routed to smaller airports or different runways. The more common extreme is an A380 followed by an Embraer regional jet, which is a medium but on the lighter end. That's still 4 minutes. And when you're running 48 arrivals per hour, losing 2 extra minutes on one pairing means you've lost 1.5 landing slots. Over a day, a handful of extreme pairings can cost you 10 or 15 movements.
The sequence optimization isn't just about order, it's about grouping. You want to cluster the heavies together so you're not constantly paying the heavy to medium penalty.
And the AMAN system does this automatically. It'll look at the inbound traffic and say, if I delay this 777 by 3 minutes and advance this A320 by 2, I can group all 4 heavies together and save 8 minutes of total spacing penalty across the hour. That optimization is happening continuously, and it's the kind of thing no human controller could calculate manually.
What's the maximum theoretical throughput of a single runway? If you optimized everything, perfect weather, all medium aircraft, visual approaches, no go-rounds, how many can you land in an hour?
The theoretical ceiling under visual flight rules, where pilots can see each other and maintain their own separation, is around 60 arrivals per hour. Airports like Las Vegas and Atlanta routinely hit 55 to 60 in good weather using visual approaches. Under instrument flight rules with radar separation, the ceiling drops to about 48 to 52. But those numbers assume all medium traffic. Mix in heavies and the number drops. Mix in low visibility and it drops further to about 36 at Heathrow in Category 3 conditions.
60 per hour. That's one every 60 seconds. At that rate, the runway is occupied by the previous aircraft until about 15 seconds before the next one touches down.
Runway occupancy time is actually the hidden bottleneck that most people don't think about. An A380 can take 60 to 70 seconds to clear the runway after touchdown. If the next aircraft is timed for a 60-second gap, there's zero margin. If the A380 is slow to exit, maybe the pilot misses the high-speed turnoff. The next aircraft is going around. That's why airports design high-speed exit taxiways at specific distances from the threshold, calculated based on typical landing roll distances for different aircraft types.
The runway itself has a designed exit choreography. The pavement geometry is part of the sequencing system.
And it gets even more interesting when you look at what's coming. NASA's Air Traffic Management Technology Demonstration, ATD-3, and Europe's CESAR program are both working on reducing separation to 2.5 nautical miles on final approach, using ADS-B precision tracking. Trials at Dallas-Fort Worth in 2025 showed a 15% increase in arrival throughput using ADS-B-based precision spacing. That's going from 48 to about 55 per hour in instrument conditions, recovering most of the gap between instrument and visual capacity.
15% is enormous. That's the equivalent of adding a third runway to a 2-runway airport without pouring any concrete.
The mechanism is trajectory prediction. Every aircraft broadcasts its precise position, speed, and intended path via ADS-B. The ground system can predict where each aircraft will be in 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 2 minutes, with accuracy down to about 15 seconds at Singapore Changi's Arrival Manager 2.0, which uses machine learning for this. If you know exactly when each aircraft will cross the threshold, you can compress the spacing to the minimum safe value without the buffers that human controllers need to account for uncertainty.
15 seconds of prediction accuracy for an event that's 2 minutes in the future. That's wild.
It opens up concepts that sound like science fiction. Sisar is working on something called Virtual Block, where aircraft are essentially assigned a moving four-dimensional slot, latitude, longitude, altitude, and time. Every aircraft has a 4D contract that it must meet at specific waypoints. If you can guarantee that aircraft A will cross the metering fix at exactly 1432 and 10 seconds, and aircraft B will cross at 1432 and 50 seconds, you can run them at 2 nautical mile separation with confidence.
The 4D contract, that's the logical endpoint of this whole system. Right now, controllers are managing aircraft reactively, giving instructions and watching responses. The future is each aircraft flying a pre-negotiated trajectory that the system has already deconflicted.
That's the vision of the FAI's next-gen and Europe's CSAR trajectory-based operations. The controller becomes more of a manager of exceptions rather than a continuous director of traffic. But we're still a long way from that. The current system is a hybrid, AMA recommendations, controller judgment, pilot compliance, and a lot of voice radio coordination. It works astonishingly well, but it's also brittle.
The brittleness. Give me an example of what happens when it breaks.
July 2024 at Heathrow. A radar failure caused a 45-minute ground stop. That's 45 minutes with zero arrivals. When the system came back online, there were dozens of aircraft that had been held on the ground across Europe, plus the ones already in the air that had been diverted or holding. It took 6 hours to clear the backlog. 6 hours of cascading delays because of a 45-minute outage. That's the fragility of a system running at 98% capacity. There's no slack to absorb disruption.
6 hours to recover from 45 minutes. That's an 8-to-1 multiplier on the disruption. The system is efficient precisely because it has no buffers, and it has no buffers precisely because efficiency demands it.
That's the fundamental tension. Every buffer you add, extra spacing, extra holding capacity, extra ground delay margin, reduces throughput. Every piece of slack you remove increases fragility. The entire history of air traffic management is navigating that trade-off.
Let me ask about the human side of this. We've talked about the technology, but you mentioned earlier that controllers are managing 12 aircraft simultaneously. What's the training pipeline for someone who's going to work approach control at a place like London Terminal Control Center?
It's about 3 to 4 years of training after initial qualification, and the washout rate is significant. Maybe 30 to 40% don't make it through. Approach control is considered the most cognitively demanding position in ATC, more than en route center control or tower control. You're making more decisions per minute, with less margin for error, in a more compressed time horizon. An en route controller might be managing aircraft that are 15 minutes from the next sector boundary. An approach controller is managing aircraft that are 2 minutes from the runway threshold.
The consequences of error are more immediate. An en route mistake might mean a loss of separation that gets corrected in 30 seconds. An approach mistake means a go-around at minimum, a mid-air at worst.
The industry has done a lot of work on fatigue management. Controllers at busy facilities work strict shift patterns with mandatory rest periods. The typical shift is around 2 hours on position, followed by a 30-minute break. You can't maintain the required level of attention for longer than that. And facilities have watch supervisors, whose job is to monitor controllers for signs of fatigue or overload and pull them off position if needed.
2 hours on, 30 off. That's more frequent rotation than I would have guessed.
It's backed by research. Cognitive performance on ATC tasks degrades measurably after about 90 to 120 minutes of sustained high-intensity work. The brakes aren't a perk, they're a safety requirement.
What does all this mean for you, the passenger? Next time you're on approach, what should you look for?
A few things. First, if you hear we've been given a holding pattern, understand that this is a deliberate, managed delay, not a failure. The system is trading fuel for safety and order. It's a feature, not a bug. Second, the visual funnel you see from the tarmac represents about 15 to 20 minutes of the total journey. The sequencing work started 200 miles and 45 minutes earlier. The visible queue is just the last act. And third, if you have a flight tracking app, Flight Radar 24, ADS-B Exchange, pull it up during approach and watch the sequence in real time. You'll see aircraft converging from different directions, slowing to specific speeds, slotting into the line. When you hear the pilot call out speed 160 knots, that's the controller compressing the flow, slowing one aircraft to create spacing for another.
The speed callouts are the audible signature of the metering system. Once you know to listen for them, you hear them everywhere.
You'll also notice that the spacing isn't uniform. A Heavy will have a bigger gap behind it. Two 737s will be tighter. The wake turbulence categories are visible in the spacing if you know what to look for.
There's something almost meditative about watching it once you understand the logic. It's not just a line of planes. It's a solved optimization problem, resolved every few seconds, made visible in lights and contrails.
That's what Daniel was getting at in the prompt. The visual capture of international travel, thousands of people from everywhere, moving at hundreds of miles per hour, all funneling toward the same strip of pavement. The miracle isn't just that it works. The miracle is that it works at 48 per hour in fog, with A380s and Cessnas mixed together and a go-around only once every 3 days.
Let me ask the forward-looking question. As autonomous aircraft and urban air mobility, drones, air taxis, enter the airspace, how does this system adapt? The current architecture is built for predictable, crewed aircraft on fixed routes. What happens when you add hundreds of small, semi-autonomous vehicles moving through the same terminal airspace?
That's the existential challenge. The current system relies on voice communication and standardized procedures that assume a trained pilot in every cockpit. An air taxi won't have a pilot. It won't respond to a radio call. It'll need to be integrated into the 4D trajectory system from day one. It can't participate in the hybrid human-machine system we have now. CSAR and NextGen are building toward that, but the timeline is uncertain. The technology exists. The regulatory framework and the certification standards don't, yet.
We're looking at a future where the funnel might get a lot more crowded, but with vehicles that can't talk to the current controllers. That's not a gradual transition. That's a phase change.
The phase change will probably happen at specific airports first. Singapore Changi, Dubai, maybe Dallas-Fort Worth. Airports with the investment capacity and the political will to build the new infrastructure. Heathrow and JFK will be slower because their airspace is more congested and their regulatory environments are more complex. But eventually, the 4D contract system will be the norm, and the voice radio that we hear on approach today will be a backup, not the primary control mechanism.
The same visual funnel, but a completely different invisible architecture behind it. The lights won't look any different from the tarmac window, but the system producing them will be unrecognizable.
That's the beauty of it. The physical experience of flying, the approach, the landing, the view out the window, hasn't fundamentally changed in 50 years. But the system managing it has transformed completely, and it's about to transform again. Most passengers will never know. They'll just look out the window, see the string of light stretching to the horizon, and wonder how it all works.
Which is exactly why we did this episode.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, the salt caravans crossing the Sahel from Taoudeni to Timbuktu were so vast that a single caravan could stretch for over 2,000 camels, carrying slabs of salt that weighed up to 60 pounds each. The trade collapsed so thoroughly that by the 1920s, European explorers reported finding entire abandoned salt trade towns in what is now Equatorial Guinea, settlements that had been built on salt wealth and then simply emptied when the route shifted, leaving behind stone storehouses still half full of crystallized salt blocks that no one had claimed in 40 years.
Abandoned salt towns. Not where I expected that to go.
Half full of salt. Just sitting there.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this one, leave us a review. It genuinely helps other people find the show. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu, it's something. your head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear holes. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.